Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience, molecular biology, and faculty associate in law and public affairs.
Well, today we're going to turn a little bit to Sam's favorite topic, gerrymandering.
One of several, but yes.
One of several, but this is definitely something you have been investing a lot of time with.
Oh, yes.
And not only have you been working on the issue, and not only have you been doing research, you even spent a day at the Supreme Court.
I did.
Last week, we didn't tape on our usual time because you were somewhere very important. And so...
Actually, there was another reason, which is that it's the day that the Nobel in, I think, was it chemistry was announced, or physics, I forget which.
Yeah.
And there was a dim chance that, there's always some chance that somebody from Princeton will get the prize.
I
think it was a physics day. And so the studio actually told us, well,
you never know.
So there are two reasons.
It worked out perfectly.
It worked out perfectly, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But yes.
So let's start... before we get into what many people don't fully get, meaning how you can get beyond crass political gerrymandering, maybe we can talk a little bit about why you were in the Supreme Court that day and what exactly you were doing there.
Yeah, well, let's see. So the baseline is that there's a case this fall, Gill versus Whitford, and it's a case that the Supreme Court is considering as a test case that will determine whether extreme partisan gerrymandering can be under the scope of the Supreme Court. They've been flirting with this for several decades, and this is the chance for them to finally figure that out. If, depending on how it works out, it has the potential to put guardrails on the whole partisan gerrymandering process. So that's why there's a case. And the reason I was there is that the Supreme Court, unless you are really close to the court, it's the most mysterious branch of the government because deliberations are not generally open. Justices' papers are not released until the death of the justice who's involved. And so the one time to see what's going on, if you're an outsider, is at oral argument, where the kinds of questions that justices ask have some predictive power in what's going to happen. And I have been, as you say, working on this topic for a while. I filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, advocating certain ways of thinking about the problem. And I wanted to see in person what those justices were going to say about the case and possibly about the nerdy little math stuff.
So you just went as a visitor?
I went as a visitor. I arranged to, well, to be more accurate, I arranged to be invited as a kind of a rank and file guest. So I arranged to be in the courtroom. It was a very in demand event.
Why? Is that always the case?
It varies. Oh. So some cases are, I would say, routine as a Supreme Court case can be. Other cases attract a lot of attention. Like, for instance, just a few years ago, the gay marriage case with Obergefell, that was very well subscribed. In this case, a lot of people know how important gerrymandering is. And in particular, because it's high profile, and also lawyers want to know how it's going to turn out. So the way it works at the Supreme Court is that the whole courtroom, not counting the justices and the clerks themselves, the courtroom holds, I think, 400 people. And there's different ways to get
in. So I didn't realize.
So there's the lawyer's line. Yeah. So if you're admitted to the Supreme Court bar, that's a special line. And if you stand in line from whatever, 4 in the morning or 7 in the morning, you can get in. Then there's the general public line. And then there's people who are guests. And I got in as a guest. And it turned out that there were a lot of lawyers in line. It's not normally the case, but there are lots of lawyers in line, and so they took up a lot of space. It turns out that the regular public line, if you want to get into the court, the official line opening is at 7 a.m., but I know people who were in line from 4 a.m. who did not get in.
Uh-huh.
Okay, wow. And so the cutoff was if you were in line, if you got into line between 2 and 3 in the morning the day of the oral argument, you could get in.
Yeah.
And if you joined the line at 4 a.m., then there's a special thing where you get to stand in back and listen for 3 minutes, then you got to keep on moving. It's like a little conveyor belt of people listening to oral arguments. And so it's very limited to, you know, look, recordings of oral arguments get released later in the day and transcripts get released. But if you want to be there and look at Anthony Kennedy in the face and just see his expression when he asks the question, then you got to stand in line or you got to get invited.
Was there anyone interesting sitting there near you?
Yeah, so the case is Gill versus Whitford. Gill is, I believe, an official who regulates elections in Wisconsin. Whitford is Bill Whitford, who is a voter in Wisconsin who was one of the voters who claimed injury in this partisan gerrymander. And I was sitting two rows behind Bill Whitford, and then next to him was Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wow.
Yeah, so
Terminator.
The governator. So the governator was two rows in front of me. And so he and Whitford were yucking it up and chatting.
And why was he there?
Schwarzenegger is very much in favor of partisan gerrymandering reform. He's a Republican.
Yeah.
But he's also, he was governor of California at a time when Proposition 11 passed, which set up a nonpartisan commission of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents to redistrict California according to take it out of the hands of legislators. And Schwarzenegger is quite proud of that. He's been making a big deal out of it. He says he wants to say hasta la vista, baby, to gerrymandering.
Yeah.
And so he's been a real advocate for that.
Right.
And then in front of them, because it's a case involving Wisconsin, sitting right in front of them was Senator Tammy Baldwin. And I actually didn't recognize her at all because I'm so used to seeing people in the newspapers and on TV. It's weird to see people in person. And so right. I know Whitford, and so I recognized him. And then someone poked me and said, "That's Schwarzenegger next to him." And I looked and I said, "Oh yeah, that is Arnold Schwarzenegger. How about that?"
Yeah,
I just thought it was some guy in a suit. And then if you're a Supreme Court nerd, then all the people who are involved in the case are all there. It's the closest thing an election nerd gets to there being a scene because you look around and you say, "Oh yeah,
right.
There's David Daley. He wrote that book about gerrymandering." And then you look over there and you say, "Yeah, there's Paul Smith. Oh, yeah, he's the star election lawyer."
Uh-huh.
And so it's for nerds only. But like you look around the room, you can see all the people who've been working on it. Then if you're a real nerd, you say, "Oh, look at that. Adam Liptak is there. Ooh."
Uh-huh.
Right? And who knows who these people are, right? But like these are the people who cover the Supreme Court.
Right. And then where do they sit, the justices?
They have a seating arrangement, of course. No
are they
surprise.
Like elevated up?
They're elevated on a dais. They have a seating arrangement where the Chief Justice, John Roberts, sits in the middle. And then they're seated by seniority. And so on John Roberts' right, which is from the audience's left, is Anthony Kennedy. On the other side, I believe, is Clarence Thomas. And then it goes out from there. And so I think, if I remember correctly, Neil Gorsuch is all the way to the right from the audience's point of view and from politics's point of view. But anyway, but he's all the way to the right. So he's doing his little turmeric thing from the right. And then there's a box in the front. So I think of it as being like being at the theater where like in the orchestra pit are the attorneys who are working on the case. And so they're in the pit. Really close to the front are lawyers who are admitted to the Supreme Court bar. Over to the right is a box, like a box of the opera. And those are special guests who are personal guests of the justices. And so those are people who are typically friends of the justices. But for ethical reasons, it can't be people who are involved in the case. Mm-hmm. It would be like, the justice's niece or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the back is where that's what I would call balcony seating. And that's where several hundred of us were seated. And so that's where, for instance, Schwarzenegger, Baldwin, we were all in balcony seating.
And then what's it? So how does it work? I've never seen this. So,
oh well,
I mean, so how do they discuss the case?
So what happens is, first off, everyone's got to be super quiet. You can't bring anything in. No electronics. The only thing you're allowed to bring if you're
a member of the audience.
Yeah, there's like metal detectors. There's lockers.
You
have to bring a quarter to like open up the locker, put your electronics away. No phone. No computer. No nothing. No overcoats. If you're in the audience, you show up with a pad of paper and a pen. That's all you're allowed. And then, of course, the justices have all their papers and supporting documents. And it was a forest of briefs. Amicus briefs are their staffs brought in piles of briefs, and they're color coded according to which side filed. And green is the side favoring the plaintiffs, or rather the appellees in this case. And so green briefs were in this case the briefs favoring reform and favoring a gerrymandering standard. And, you know, I walk in, I'm sitting there watching and I have to be quiet, but I see that the clerks are bringing piles of green briefs. And so right there I see that all the interesting intellectual action is probably going to involve some of those briefs that are in favor of reform. And everyone has stuff. Clarence Thomas turns out to have like a whole bunch of stuff because he habitually has a lot of reading.
Mm-hmm.
Is he reading during oral arguments or does he just want to have it for looks? But for whatever reason, Clarence Thomas always has a big pile of stuff around him, like reading material. But everyone's got some reading material. Thomas has the most of all. So the way it works is the case opens up and it's 1 hour for oral argument. And typically the court hears typically one or two cases in the morning, most often two, the 10 o'clock case, the 11 o'clock case. Gerrymandering was the 10 o'clock case. And the 10 o'clock case oral arguments last for 1 hour, half an hour for each side. in this case, the half hour for the state of Wisconsin, which was against regulating gerrymanders, and so against regulation or perhaps mm-hmm. anti-reform, that was divided between two attorneys. And then the second half is for the Whitford plaintiffs. Mm-hmm. And so and what happens is whatever attorney is up at bat starts presenting the case. There's all kinds of rules for that, too. Like you can't have the attorney cannot have a pad of paper that flips up vertically. He or she can only have one open sideways. I think it's because the judges don't like looking at it. It's distracting to them. Uh-huh. And so the justices are supposed to listen to the mm-hmm. attorney and not be distracted. And if the attorney has a book, the whole thing is really impossibly twee.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just all these rules regulating what can be done. Anyway, so the attorney gets up, opens up his portfolio that opens left, right, and starts making his argument. And then after a minute or two, the justices start leaping in.
So they interrupt.
Yeah. And so what happens there is that interruptions typically are more, they can be made by any justice who has a question to ask. It is more often the case that a justice who is skeptical of the argument being presented, that then that justice will interrupt and ask a question. And so at some level, even if you have no idea what's being discussed, you can just keep score and just count how many times a given justice interrupts. And right out of the gate, the first justice to leap in and to start asking hard questions of the state of Wisconsin was Anthony Kennedy. He was very interested in what they had to say. There were several major legal points that came up. Does any Democratic voter in the state of Wisconsin have standing to challenge a state map, even if they don't live in a district that is gerrymandered? Mm-hmm. And that turns out to be a question of standing. That was a big question that was on Kennedy's mind. And then another question is, well, how would you measure the amount of harm? And that's the part where my statistical stuff came in.
Meaning how much harm a gerrymander does to an individual voter?
Well, yes, except not to an individual voter. So the way that voting rights work is that most voting rights law has focused on one person, one vote, and has focused on the harms to an individual or maybe their ethnic group. So, for example, the Voting Rights Act regulates the representational rights of a minority group. Mm-hmm. Say, for instance, if African Americans are crammed into a district where there's 80% of them, then that's a harm against them because they only have one person they can vote for and they're all jammed into one district. If they get spread across districts, so they're always 20% of voters across a whole bunch of districts, that is also a harm because then they have no opportunity to elect somebody who might be sympathetic to their issues. And so there's two kinds of harm. So one kind of harm is direct. Another kind of harm would be voter ID cases, where if you are denied the right to vote, then that's, by some justices, is considered a harm. Mm-hmm. So partisan gerrymandering is weird. Kennedy, if he rules in favor of the Whitford plaintiffs, he has to more or less create a new right. And the new right, and I have to be careful here because I'm not a lawyer. He's hinted at this in past decisions. The right goes as follows. The right is that of a partisan voter. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, this is the hypothetical that he or someone else asked. I forgot who asked it. But the hypothetical is, if there's a voter who is packed into a district in northern Wisconsin, mm-hmm. in a rural area, and if a voter of the same party in Milwaukee, which is not rural, if a voter in Milwaukee, can that voter in Milwaukee file suit on the grounds that his or her interests have been harmed by jamming a bunch of co-partisans mm-hmm. into a district on the other side of the state? And so the question is that. And Kennedy's position, stated somewhat indirectly in oral argument, appeared to be yes. So the idea would be suppression of one's freedom of association. According to Kennedy, contained within the First Amendment is the right to associate with people you agree with. Freedom of association and of expression of your political opinions. And if you choose to associate with a party, you're choosing to associate with a number of interests, mm-hmm. Issue topics that you care about. And therefore, you have an interest in making sure that everyone in your party has a fair shake and gets the opportunity to elect somebody. And so the logic would be, therefore, you can be harmed by somebody on the other side of the state being packed into a district. Mm-hmm. And that was the fundamental point. So that came up in oral argument, and Kennedy seemed sympathetic to that idea. So it's it's not so much the right of an individual, but it's the right of members of a whole party measured at a statewide level.
Were there any justices questioning the other way, meaning more hostile toward that idea?
Oh, yeah. I would say that the justices who are almost certain to vote against this claim are Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas. Mm-hmm. And Thomas never says anything, but Gorsuch and Alito were critical of this. They were suspicious of this idea, and they were skeptical about the idea of creating a new right. Now,
they ask questions of the presenter.
Yeah, they ask questions of each other.
Say, how could that be legitimate?
Right. They ask questions of the questioner. At some point, if things get heated enough, at some point the justices start harshing on each other a little bit.
Oh, they do.
Well,
yeah.
That's considered it's considered a notable event because, you know, these are not young people. And so like the whole thing is very structured. And so if they start going after each other, then that's considered strong stuff. Mm-hmm. So at one point, Gorsuch attempted to towards the end of the hour of oral argument, Gorsuch attempted to return to what he said was returning to the Constitution. And he was skeptical about finding new rights in the Constitution. And he didn't think that some technical stuff was in the Constitution. And he started wanting to know exactly where in the Constitution such a right could be found. And he listed the 12th Amendment, the 19th Amendment, and some other amendments. And then Ginsburg, who had been pretty quiet for a while, roused herself and said, "What about one man, one vote?" Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of this little faint feeling in the courtroom. Like the whole courtroom went, ooh.
Yeah.
Because it was because she was, of course, correct that one man, one vote is built on the 14th Amendment,
right,
which is one of the post-Civil War amendments. And so she was correct that one person, one vote is a standard that emerged from that. And that was not something that Gorsuch had cited. And so she was basically schooling Gorsuch on his view of his what she viewed was a selective reading of the Constitution.
Can you see anything from their face? I don't know how close. I mean, are there do they visibly express their feelings?
I couldn't tell. I was just a little bit far to see small changes in facial expression, but certainly the tone was Ginsburg spanking Gorsuch for misquoting the Constitution for selectively reading the Constitution. So here's one question that came up that I think really revealed Kennedy's thinking, which is this. He said he was asking one of the Wisconsin attorneys, he said, "Consider this hypothetical. What if there was a law in Wisconsin, if the Wisconsin state constitution said that districting should be done according to traditional principles, such as keeping communities of interest together, making sure that they weren't too funny shapes, but to give a maximum advantage to party X over party Y? Would that be constitutional?" Mm-hmm. And at first, the attorney for Wisconsin wouldn't say, and then the questioning went on, and then Kennedy came back and was clearly exasperated and said, "You haven't answered my question."
Yeah.
And eventually, one of the attorneys, a woman named Murphy, eventually conceded that, in fact, it would be unconstitutional. And at that point, a point has been made, which is that if something is done in law and it's unconstitutional, why would it be that if the legislature does it without making a law, if they do it mm-hmm. in the act of making a law, like why would that be constitutional? So at that point, Kennedy had made his point. And it seemed pretty clear from the line of questioning that he's very strong. You know, he's reasonably strongly inclined to say that that injury against a party at a statewide level is a constitutional event.
So the issue is, we've had gerrymandering forever.
Yes,
right. It's not new.
No,
and the courts never dealt with this really until 1962-64, and that's when the one man, one vote idea comes. Right.
Yeah.
And there was resistance to entering the political thicket.
Yeah.
Because the idea was, even if bad things are happening or unfair things, how's the court supposed to figure out what's going
on
and what to do? What's the remedy?
Yeah, I would say that roughly speaking, voting law has become more technical and more oriented towards representing people in some kind of fair way. And that the one person, one vote era, starting from the 1960s with decisions like Reynolds versus Sims and Westbury versus Connecticut, there were a few decisions that happened in the 60s that started really focusing on relating representation to how people vote. And so even though gerrymandering has been around for 200 years, right from the beginnings of the Republic, it's really in the last 50 years that there's been more focus on finding ways to represent groups fairly, finding ways to make sure that everyone has their say. And this one person, one vote doctrine has matured. And so I would say that the idea of making sure that groups get represented fairly has really matured in the last 50 years. And I think partisan gerrymandering has really come to the fore in the last 20 years. And my reading of the history of it is that the reason for that is that gerrymandering is done for all kinds of reasons. And it's the court has already decided that you can gerrymander one district to favor one legislator. That's okay. Mm-hmm. And it's really only in the last 20 years, especially post-2000, that partisan gerrymandering has become so extreme and so widespread that it started to have an effect on how much representation either party gets. And that's really a post-2000 phenomenon. If you look at the, if you look at some simple statistical tests that I've cooked up, or more accurately, some 100-year-old tests that I've applied, really there's been about one bad gerrymander per decade starting from the 70s onward. And it's really only after 2000 that there was more of them. Like after 2000, there were five of them. After 2010, there were again five or six of them. And so starting after 2000, these extreme gerrymanders became so frequent that they've become, you know, an epidemic.
And why 2000? What happened?
Well, a few things have happened.
Technology?
Yeah, I wrote a piece in the American Prospect that's in the current issue that I think people could look up called Slaying the Partisan Gerrymander. And Brian Remlinger and I wrote a piece outlining, it's like a police procedural.
Yeah.
Means, motive, opportunity. So the motive is that partisanship has gotten worse since the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a motivation to not just protect individuals, but to make your team, if you're a partisan, to make your team as large as possible. So that's motive. Means, which is technological ways of drawing districts to do a better and better job of it. And then opportunity, well, starting in 2010 in particular, that was a wave election for the Republicans. And so everybody wants to gerrymander. It so happens that the Republicans got the opportunity in 2010. And so all the bad gerrymanders, maybe with the exception of Maryland, but there's half a dozen gerrymanders across the country that emerged after 2010 because one side got the opportunity because the Republicans took over a bunch of legislatures across the country.
That's what Daley wrote about.
And that's what Daley wrote about. And he also wrote about Maryland, but just there's more things to talk about on the Republican side. And so you can see that there's a jump in representation that happened exactly at 2010. Mm-hmm. And that jump tells you that it's not geography. It tells you that it's specifically something that somebody did drawing lines. And so it's a convergence that has all come together in our age of polarization.
So it's getting worse.
Yeah.
There is more attention all the way back to the 60s to the equity of how voting is done.
Yeah.
There's also this concern, which is an area of disagreement, but some believe that gerrymandering is part of the problem in terms of polarization, that you're creating these districts.
Yeah. I think if one were drawing causal arrows to say what caused what, it would be approximately that polarization caused increased partisan gerrymandering, which then amplifies the effects of polarization.
So then this comes to the court now that you sat and watched. And so what – and so the – again, the problem is always, A, should the court be dealing with this?
Yeah.
And then B, and I think Kennedy said this, but maybe I'm wrong, a while back. Like what – to give him – was it Kennedy to give him a standard?
Yeah. So what he said back in 2004, there were two cases. One was – called Veith versus Jubilee, and the other was Lulac versus Perry. So there's some cases about 10, 13 years ago after that cycle where he said that he was inclined to support a claim on constitutional grounds, but what he lacked was a manageable standard, manageable meaning something that a judge can apply and leave his or her own covert biases perhaps out of it and just have something that's reasonably systematic that could be applied to just say, you know, is it a gerrymander? Cut, and then say, okay, if it is, then make them redraw it. If it's not, then case dismissed. And so what he wanted was something that was manageable, which I think means manageable by lower courts where there's a straightforward approach that can be taken.
And you think and others think there is a straightforward formula.
Right. So the plaintiffs in Whitford, they had an idea.
Yeah.
So roughly, to back up a little bit, math is part of the idea.
Okay.
But we can first talk about the part that's not math because that part seems a little bit safer. So one way, there's this great constitutional Supreme Court reporter. There's a great Supreme Court reporter named Lyle Denniston, and he speculated about what Kennedy might do. And he's usually right about what the court's going to do. And what he suggested is that it would be a test that is something like this. a test in which one party has control over the districting process and in which the overriding motivation was to create a partisan advantage. Not that it's the only motivation, but it's the overriding motivation, more than any other motivation. And so that's a thing that you can do and be a judge and, you know, weigh things without without getting into the muck of math. And so one possibility is that Kennedy is going to say, well, that's how you do it. Another possibility, which I think is probably necessary, but it's sort of unclear how it's going to play out, is establishing some way of measuring how much harm occurred. And so a way of measuring the amount of harm, according to the plaintiffs in Whitford, would be a measure that was invented 3 or 4 years ago called the efficiency gap.
Okay.
And so that's efficiency gap is basically a formula that Chief Justice Roberts teed off on a little bit.
Okay.
But it's a formula that uses how many seats either side wins and how wide their margins are, and takes those and put them into a formula to figure out how many net votes were wasted. And so it's basically a formula that tells you if the results are way out of whack with the number of votes that were cast. And in particular, it's a measure of how many votes were considered to be wasted. And the formula says if more than 7% of votes were wasted, then efficiency gap is more than 7%, then this would be deemed a large effect. And so that's what the plaintiffs offered. Now, the lower court—
They offered the efficiency gap, not the first one.
They offered the efficiency gap. Right. Now, the lower court didn't go for that. The lower court said—
Why?
One would have to go through the opinions to figure out exactly why, but basically they thought that I think there were concerns raised by the state of Wisconsin that it sets off alarms too often. Like in about 50% of cases across the country, the efficiency gap, as measured from election results, is large enough that it would set off alarms. And for 50% of states to have a positive result on the efficiency gap test seems like it's too much. And so it seems more appropriate to think about the efficiency gap as being a helpful piece of information, which is what the lower court said, but not a central part of the test. The plaintiffs on the Whitford side said, well, we've got a bunch of other tests. And then the conservatives on the Supreme Court said, too many tests. It's a hodgepodge. Why are you giving us so many tests? Do you even know what you're doing? Like roughly the feeling on the part of Gorsuch, Roberts, and Alito is you've given us so many tests. How are we to believe this stuff? It seems quite dependent on social science. And the phrase used by Roberts was sociological gobbledygook.
Uh-huh.
And so at that point—
What does he mean by that? Why is he using that?
So there was,
what's the criticism?
So this is a time when it was helpful to be in the room because
There
was just this look on Roberts' face, and there's this tone in his voice. He said that he was concerned about the court being overly politicized.
Yep.
And what is the man on the street going to think when the court says, well, we applied a formula where sigma for one party minus sigma for the other party divided by sigma for one party plus sigma for the other party is greater than 7%, that man on the street is going to think it's a bunch of baloney. Now, I'm sitting in the audience and I'm thinking, okay, I have my problems with the efficiency gap, but I'm thinking, well, okay, I'm not the man on the street, but my thinking is, what I think is that then you would have an objective standard that would not involve your own political biases getting into it. So my feeling was that maybe there's problems with the efficiency gap, but geez, like, wouldn't it be good to have a formula? But Roberts was having none of it. You know, judges don't enter the study of the law because they don't enter the study of the law because they love math.
Yeah.
They just don't.
Right.
And so there's other ways to measure it that are simpler. And, you know, the reason I filed an amicus brief is that I think there are simpler ways to measure it that don't involve—
You mean other than the efficiency gap?
Yeah. So here's
you have your own—
Yeah, here's a simple measure.
You have your own sociological gobbledygook.
No, that's not fair. I have something that, like, I think I have something that's so old it's got whiskers.
Uh-huh.
And so it's—
And what's that?
So first I'll say what the test is, and I'll say how old it is. So the test is you've got a state, let's say Wisconsin, and you've got a bunch of Democratic seats and a bunch of Republican seats.
Yeah.
And let's say the Democrats won with 70% of the vote on average, and let's say the Republicans won with 55% on average. Okay, so that means that the Democrats won in a more lopsided fashion than the Republicans. And it's possible to do a statistical test to say that that is unlikely to have arisen by chance. If one side's winds are more lopsided than the other, if their average winds are heavier, it is indication that they were packed into a few districts. And it turns out that comparing one average with another average is quite literally the oldest test in the book. Freshmen in college learned this. High school students learned this. It was it was designed 100 years ago. It's called the student t-test. It was designed by this guy named Gossett, who is trying to do quality control on hops for the Guinness Brewing Company. So 110 years ago, Guinness was shipping 750 million pints of beer a year all over the world, or at least across the ocean, and they needed to have reliable hops because hops is used as a preservative to keep beer from going off. And Gossett figured out how many samples of hops you have to average to figure out whether the average has gone off some standard. Yeah. And so he thought of that, and it's subsequently been used like every day. Like you can find it in Microsoft Excel. Students do it. Every member of my lab can do it. Like most of my undergraduates can do it. Maybe a few don't, and then I yell at them because I'm like, dude, you have to be able to do it basic.
So it's basic.
It's basic. It's like really – so so you know, is it gobbledygook? I mean, I would say that if anything involving a number and statistics is gobbledygook, then it's under Roberts' definition of gobbledygook. But – if you know, if you're willing to say there's an objective way to measure a thing, then you know, I don't know, it's a thing that my laptop sitting right here, you know.
So the idea would be though that the court, as they decide this case, would A, say, well, there is a standard we can use.
Yeah.
They wouldn't necessarily have to pick between the standards.
Yeah.
So, and then
let the lower court sort it out.
So
Kennedy is no mathematician, and so it's likely, like I'd say a relatively likely outcome would be Kennedy would say the First Amendment says that overriding partisan intent is a sign of a gerrymander, and that if there is some evidence of asymmetry between the parties, then that would tell you that there was an injury and that the lower courts should work it out. Because generally speaking, the Supreme Court is not going to deal in formulas. I mean, that certainly Roberts is correct in that case. It's more like Kennedy's going to say something about the Constitution, the First Amendment, and unfairness, and how basic fairness is the overriding principle. Now, you guys in the circuit courts and the district courts, you go work it out, and then we'll let it get sorted out in the next couple of years.
But that, I mean, that's the part, I think, for people who don't follow this, that's more difficult. So if the court says there is something to do, we don't need to continue a system we've had really since the start.
Oh,
it's gotten worse.
Yeah.
So we can get rid of partisan gerrymandering.
Yeah.
Here are formulas that help you do it. Math.
Yeah.
What do you envision as someone working on this? Who's going to – the courts would challenge anyone who doesn't adhere to a certain
– Yeah. So at that point, somebody needs to bring a case. So for instance, there have been some there have been some lower court cases that have been put on pause, waiting for this one to shake out. So, for instance, North Carolina. In North Carolina, there is single-party control over redistricting, the Republicans. That's likely to continue because the governor in North Carolina, unusually among states, the governor has no say in redistricting. So it's this Republican legislature. Because of partisan gerrymandering, it's likely to stay Republican in the future.
Yeah.
And so those men and women are in charge of redistricting. If you look at the record, they shut out the Democrats.
Yeah.
They drew the maps. And so a likely way this would play out would be that there are some cases percolating down there. And then the lower court will say, okay, the Supremes told us to look for overriding partisan intent, and they told us to look for some form of symmetry. And the plaintiffs have suggested, you know, the t-test or another test called the mean median test. The plaintiffs have suggested a few tests, and I look at them, and I, the judge, say, yeah, looks bad to me, and then gets applied and say, according to Gill versus Whitford, you guys have to redraw the map and satisfy us that you have not violated these principles that, that Kennedy told us in Gill versus Whitford.
So the same way the Voting Rights Act of 65 established criteria in terms of what has to happen with registration. Otherwise, we'll send in registrars.
Yeah, like for instance,
have to change the plan.
Right, or more recently, Obergefell. That guy Obergefell and his partner could get married as a result of the gay marriage ruling. But it wasn't just him and his partner.
Yeah.
It was men and women across America who wanted to get into same-sex partnerships. Men and women across America had the same right that Obergefell got, and then registrars across the country had to comply. except for, you know, Kim Davis, right? Yep. So there's one exception that was high profile. But, you know, remarkably orderly. I mean, think about all the crazy things that are happening in our society. The rule of law is, I think, relatively orderly. The Supreme Court says something should happen. It percolates down. And then officials say, well, I don't like it, but the law now says I have to do X, yeah. and so therefore I will do X. And that's really one of the more stable aspects of our society currently,
right?
Say, compared with, I don't know, the risk of nuclear war,
yeah.
That's
true. Right.
With the little dictator or whatever.
Rocket Man. Please.
Get your terms correct. Yeah. Tiny Dancer and Rocket Man.
But wait. So two follow-ups on that.
Yeah, sure.
One is, you believe, or supporters on this side of the case believe, that that formula can be protected from politics. That's an assumption.
It is.
And then B, I assume the other argument beyond what Gorsuch said would be that shouldn't it be left to the electoral process?
Right.
Like,
so,
voters
right.
vote for the party in power, the party in power has that party. Why should the courts yeah. intervene? And so, why should we have math in this? And
yeah. So the principled argument against it. So one yeah. thing that was interesting during oral argument was that nobody is willing to say that partisan gerrymandering was a good thing.
Right.
No one was willing to defend it. And, you know, Sotomayor got in there and was pretty critical. Like, she said, can you come up with any positive good that comes out of this? And nobody was willing to do that. And that's always been the case. But the principled objection has been the drawing of districts is an inherently political process, and judges should not be getting into the mix. And it should be left to legislatures to engage in this thicket of political activity, and judges should just simply stay out of it. So the principled argument has been that. And then the principled argument on the other side, on the reform side, is it may be that 100 years ago that was possible, but now that we protect individual voting rights and now that representation is supposed to in some way yeah. reflect the will of the voters, we now know enough technically, and we have a theory of voting rights that says that there's a defect, this bug that needs to be repaired. And furthermore, it can persist for 10 years. And so in the case of North Carolina, I mean, that's a good case because, as I was saying before, those men and women on the Republican side can keep themselves in power indefinitely by simply keeping themselves in the majority long enough to get to the next cycle of redistricting. And it's like lifting themselves up by their bootstraps. They never have to come down. And so I think the argument is it vitiates the right to vote, because if what Ginsburg calls the precious right to vote, if it's fruitless to vote, then that robs people of what democracy is supposed to be about.
Yeah. Why does someone like Schwarzenegger care about it so much? I mean, obviously he was governor, so he saw, but why is this an issue that
it's interesting
that he'd be there sitting near you watching?
Yeah, I don't know exactly the yeah. particulars of it. I think
I know you're not a Schwarzenegger expert, but I'm just curious generally, like, why would this?
As far as I can tell, yeah. the probable reasons are that it's a reform that started in California, and he's right. proud of that, and it went well. And the other reason is that even though he's nominally a Republican, look, he's not a doctrinaire Republican. He's sort of one of these moderate Republicans who hasn't gone along with the rest of his party. And if you look at the amicus briefs in the case, the amicus briefs on the Whitford side were bipartisan. John McCain and Sheldon Whitehouse, a yeah. bipartisan pair of senators, filed an amicus brief saying it's time for reform. I believe Governor Kasich co-signed a brief, if I remember correctly. And so governors, members of Congress, state legislators, in all three cases, members of legislatures on both sides of the aisle have come together and said it's time to put guardrails to cabin off the very worst versions of this practice.
Yeah.
So
it'd be the worst versions, because the other thing that comes to mind is, what would districts look like? It's easy to see how partisanship shapes districts.
Yeah.
Parties carve out districts that are going to yeah. keep. What's the alternative? Would it be random?
Well,
would there be a logic to it?
So there are math nerds who have all kinds of awesome reform ideas about what to do, which is to only have straight lines. Like, to just draw straight lines across.
Geographic.
Yeah, that's one kind of idea. Another idea is to have it done automated by computer. So there are all kinds of idealistic views about how to do it, but they all turn out to have flaws, the greatest of which is, who would ever go for such a plan? Who would ever consent to having their neighborhood, like with a line drawn right down the middle, like a superhighway splitting up a neighborhood. Another problem is that any set of rules you could set up would inevitably be gameable. Like if, right. like it's just like, you know, like you people look for technicalities, and any set of rules is likely to be gameable. We're at Princeton, we're doing research to prove that, and so I actually have people doing large scale simulations to prove that any set of rules can be gamed. So the likelier thing to do would be, just to back up a step, the Supreme Court is only going to block off the very worst offenses.
Yeah.
And then there's this wide range of possibilities. And at that point, individual states have to do something about reform. And at that point, it turns into an individual state maybe setting up a commission.
Like California.
Like California.
System. Okay.
Yeah, or like setting up rules. And so right. at that point, it turns into setting up a process in which both parties are at the table in some way that does not lead to a stalemate. And that's tough, right? Because these right. are problems that that didn't really exist in their current form 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And so it's a live problem in democracy. It sounds obscure. It sounds
right.
very technical.
Very, very.
Right? right? It's like this is a boring tech. Like when I talk to audiences in front of this, I was at Lafayette College, and this very smart man in the audience was really concerned about voter ID and about certain groups being denied the right to vote. And it was interesting because that inspires passions. Like it's a bummer to not, it's
yes.
a terrible offense to have one's personal right to vote taken away.
Right. Not gerrymandering.
But I looked at him and I said, look, you think that gerrymandering is technical, but gerrymandering, no matter how well your right to vote is protected, if you don't have anybody to vote for, then you are still robbed of your vote.
Yeah.
And the effects are larger. Like if you have, in the state of Pennsylvania, if you have 8 people you could vote for, that's different from when if you could have 5 people to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
Like you may think you have the right to
yeah.
vote,
yeah, yeah.
but your vote is worthless. And so that's a really hard thing to get across. It's kind of funny because I'm a nerd. And I think this is super important for our democracy, yet it makes people glaze over a little bit. Like poor Justice Roberts with his sociological gobbledygook.
That was Roberts, right? Yeah.
Yes. I love that phrase, sociological gobbledygook.
Yeah, and that's why it's surprising that it would be packed. And it's not surprising that it would be packed. It's surprising in that this is not as exciting as or energizing as voting fraud or following the president's yeah. latest tweets. But on the other hand, it gets right to the heart of political power. So you
oh,
understand
yeah.
why every lawyer would be there.
Oh, lawyers were out the door. It was,
right. This is what yeah. you want to know.
Yeah, yeah. People wanted to know. Yeah, that
so,
was. Yeah.
So then you left. The court case ends.
Case
you
ends.
Walk out. What happens?
Well, first thing is there's this press scrum outside, and then Schwarzenegger and Bill Whitford.
For you?
No, not for me. Like I'm just yes. like I'm just a rank and file guy at that point. So
our show's really gotten big. Yeah,
yeah that's right. I was surrounded.
right.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Yeah.
So no, but Schwarzenegger's out there. He's surrounded by reporters, and he yeah. says his one line that he always says. I want to say hasta la vista. You know, he does that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, to my thinking, that's a little weird. Like it's this artificial news event where oral argument ends, and so everybody rushed out of the room. The second case of the day, which was it was concerning indefinite detention of prisoners. So it appeared that nobody really wanted to be around for that. So like over half the people in the
That's
room
yeah.
left the room for that. I think partly because indefinite detention under current conditions, that was a case where they were waiting for the new justice, Gorsuch, to join.
Uh-huh.
And so that was basically a case of throwing a Muslim to the lions.
Yeah.
Right. So who wants to watch that? I mean, like, you know how it's going to, you know, I kind of feel like you know how it's going to turn out. So everybody wanted that to be there for the partisan gerrymandering case. It's hot right now. Obviously, for liberals, for progressives, it's a big topic.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's something that has cross-party appeal.
Yeah.
And I think there's a general – my take is that you can tell me what you think. I'm curious about your take on this. I think there's a general recognition that there is instability in American democracy that's been revealed in various ways that came to a head last year. And I don't know, I'm curious about what your take on this is.
I go both ways. On the one hand, I think that, yes, some of the flaws of where the partisan system went and the dysfunctions of our politics went are so pronounced now that it creates more interest in how can we do something about everything we're watching. And all of a sudden, something like partisan gerrymandering
yep.
matters the same way electoral college matters, or these issues that might seem secondary.
Under normal conditions, that they don't pop out,
Right. They don't pop out.
Like, like there was a famous gerrymander in the 1980s where Democrats in California committed a mega gerrymander
under
Phil Burton. Right. And but that doesn't like it's just part of the landscape of bad things that people on either side did.
The question is though, I mean, in the end, and this is why some of the things I was asking are interesting to me, it is going to be a just like it's a political problem, it requires a political solution. And even what you're saying, the courts can stop the most egregious cases, but it's going to be incumbent on states to then set up systems and insulate them.
Yeah.
And that only happens when there's real political pressure to do that. So
that
voters have to care.
That is true, but that is that is happening. It's sort of under the radar. So, for instance, although unless it's local, like there's a woman who's in her late 20s in Michigan who's never been involved in politics before. She's gotten really worked up about this issue, and she's launched a petition drive to get a reform on the ballot, which is the formation of a commission that will redistrict Michigan. She is spearheading a signature gathering drive. They've gathered at least 100,000 signatures. They're probably close to 200,000 now. And they are on track to get their initiative on the ballot. And so there's...
That gives you optimism.
Well, because I think the way to really reform this, in most cases, has to be through voter initiative. Because legislators aren't going to take away
Never.
Their own rights.
Right.
Like, why would legislators ever give up their own prerogatives in such a way? Like, they like being in the hen house.
Right.
Right? Like, why would a
never works that way.
Right, right. And so it has to come from popular movement. So I think that ultimately fixing this, it's kind of like I was studying, I've been super interested in the Gilded Age lately and how it indirectly led to the Progressive Era. And I've been just interested in both the Gilded Age and the decades that came after. How did reforms occur? And one of the things I started reading about was late Gilded Age and then early 20th century. How did women get the right to vote? And I never really understood, and you're going to laugh at me for being such a bad history student. I didn't understand that women got the right to vote in individual states first, and then eventually So this is what I'm like. So eventually the reform went to a national level.
Right.
And so I've been really interested in
that happens a lot of reform.
Yeah, but I'm interested in like the good things that came after the Gilded Age, because the Gilded Age was a time of corruption, but reforms came out afterwards, right?
That's the optimist in you, right?
Well, what's the alternative? Nuclear rubble?
That's true. That's true.
Right?
Well, on that note, we are going to wrap up our episode. We're out of time, and thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.